Hello and welcome to the What's Up podcast, produced in association with the Royal Observatory Edinburgh.
My name is Martin Black and I'm an optical engineer at the UK Astronomy Technology Centre.
My name is Alistair Bruce. I'm in my third year of the astronomy PhD and I study active galaxies.
My name is William Taylor and I'm a project scientist, so I research massive stars, but I spend my time working with engineers to build stuff.
And the three of us together work at the Royal Observatory Edinburgh. The three of us give a monthly winter talk at the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh, in which we cover sort of what's up in the night sky, what's up in the astronomy news. And we thought maybe doing a podcast would be another way to give this information out there and something that we quite frankly just enjoy doing. So I guess in that line, should we start off with talking about what's coming up in the night sky or what's interesting in the night sky?
Yeah, I can take that if you want. First though, confessions. When was the last time any of the three of us went stargazing? Anyone going to admit?
I took the bins out last night and I saw stars.
Okay, that counts. I haven't been actively using my telescope for about 5 months, I think.
Yeah, it might be a little bit longer for me.
I'm afraid. I have not used a telescope in a long time. Yeah,
okay. I did use a homemade John Lewis telescope, from which they were selling as a spin-off from their silly advert.
Really?
Yeah.
Which they were doing that?
Yeah, it was pretty good for a £2 telescope, but pretty poor for a real telescope.
£2 telescope?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it was £2 at the end of the season.
Yeah, okay, they were trying to sell it at a higher price and it didn't sell. So
this is the advert that allows you to zoom in to the moon.
Yeah, which was quite confusing for my six-year-old niece who didn't quite understand that the small telescope she had bought from John Lewis wouldn't allow us to have the same view as she got on the advert from John Lewis. But this is a different issue.
This is an angry rant that I can provide on demand.
Yes.
It's a bit depressing, though, because like, there's always been that thing where everybody knows what Jupiter looks like, and Jupiter through a telescope looks great, but if you're expecting Hubble Jupiter, you're going to be disappointed because it'll be black and white and small.
Yeah, I think Hubble has spoiled amateur astronomy, to be honest.
And John Lewis has turned that up to 11 by saying, you can do this.
Let's blame John Lewis, not Hubble. Yeah. Anyway, let's say you didn't have a telescope, what could we see in the night sky?
Okay, so I guess that's the caveat, though. I haven't been out, so I feel a bit guilty telling other people what to be doing on their stargazing. But it's this time of year, so it's all about Orion. I'm not wrong in saying that, right?
Yeah, it's Orion time.
Yeah, so it's your classic constellation. It's the one that's hourglass-shaped, and I like to tell people it's a Scottish person because of that hourglass shape. He's clearly wearing a kilt. He's meant to be a hunter.
This fact is debatable. That's the Welsh one.
But the hourglass shape is great because it's very hard to miss, and it'll be obvious even from bright cities as long as you've got a bit of clear sky. In the top left hand corner is my favorite star in the sky. It's called Betelgeuse, and Patrick Muir would shout at me for not calling it Betelgeuse, but it's very orangey red and it's a supernova waiting to happen. So this is a very massive star, and at some point it's going to go pop, and in terms of astronomy timescales, it's going to happen really soon. In terms of our lifetimes, we might never see it go bang, but that's a fun star because of that. Also in Orion, you've got the Orion's Belt, which is the three stars all similar brightness in a perfect straight line. That's very handy for extra reasons, because one, it helps you know you're in Orion. The second thing is if you follow the straight line down the way, it points you towards Sirius, which is the brightest star in the sky. So that is worth knowing as well if you want to prove to people it's not an aeroplane. And then in addition to these things, Orion also has the Orion Nebula, which is like the king of the fuzzy things in the sky. So this particular fuzzy thing is it's called an emission nebula. So very, very young stars. They're emerging from a cocoon of gas and dust, and they're very, very bright, and they actually basically burn off what's left of that gas and dust that they formed from. And we get to see it as a beautiful sort of reflection emission nebula. So it's very, very pretty, even in quite small telescopes. So if anybody got a telescope or was lucky enough to get one for Christmas, or even binoculars would be good, that is definitely one of the first things you want to be pointing it at.
Not the John Lewis one.
Not the John Lewis.
It wouldn't see it.
Well, officially, it's visible to the naked eye.
Well, that's true.
The Orion Nebula.
Yeah.
So,
you wouldn't see any detail. You have been a really dark sky site.
Oh, I mean, the sword itself is you do see the nebula. You don't. I mean, you kind of see the. You're not just seeing the stars when you see. I think that's the best thing about the sword is it's the one object you go and look at in the night sky, and you're not looking at a star. It's a bit of a collection of stars, a little bit of gas and dust, and then there's loads more of that which we can't see. But that's the awesome thing about that patch of sky is it's fundamentally different to every other patch of sky you ever look at.
I think one of the nice things that I've always been impressed with the Orion Nebula is when instruments on big telescopes are commissioned, a lot of the sort of imagers and early spectrographs, one of the first objects you aim for on a commissioning run where you're testing the instrument before you hand it off to the scientists is the Orion Nebula, partly because it's fairly easy to find and pretty bright. So if you can't find that, you might have a problem. But moreover, there's always interesting stuff to look at it. No matter what instrument you're using, there's always something interesting in it and possibly something new to have a look at as well.
Yeah, I might be wrong here. Isn't that also the Horsehead Nebula? That's tucked away around the corner.
Well, just up from, it's the same. I mean, Orion is full of the whole, it's a massive star formation region. There's a whole range of different patches of material.
I have a feeling you need a whole big bit of kit to see the Horsehead from your back garden.
You need good filters.
You need good filters and a lot of exposure time.
So that's doable. Yeah.
It's doable.
Yeah, okay. It's not crazy.
I've seen some photographs from guys in the US that have done it, but you are talking reasonably large telescope, sort of 12 inches plus, nice filters, and then many, many hours of exposure.
So a good tripod.
Good stable tracking. Very good.
Good patience as well.
Yeah.
But it's a bit of a holy grail, isn't it? Yeah.
I've got bragging rights because I saw the aurora at Hogmanay, which was quite impressive.
You claim this. I was somewhat surprised.
It's totally true. I went online to check it. So if anybody cares about the aurora, there's a website called Aurora Watch, which is very simple. It's just a big graph and it updates every 15 minutes or so. And if the graph turns red, you've got a good chance of seeing the aurora from the UK. So get the outside if it's dark.
We can be very technical and explain what the graph actually means, but it's all pretty boring. So yeah, when it goes red, go look outside.
Yeah, graph goes red, you've got a chance of seeing something. But to be honest, that graph doesn't update fast enough because the aurora can come and go pretty quickly.
And it's sort of can be quite local as well.
So I think actually Twitter is the thing to use.
Yeah,
because I was straight onto Twitter as soon as I could see it. So this was about 5 minutes before the bells and classic Edinburgh aurora because it's in the north and it's not too bright because this wasn't a crazy bright auroral storm. So what you see looks like light pollution. So it's like there's a building site over the horizon with floodlights and you're seeing that sort of scattered light off the cloud.
It wasn't in the direction of that big flare thing on the power station.
It wasn't next to the Mossmorran orange flare or nothing. No. So, but it was very white light and I was on top of the crags at the time looking north and there isn't enough light for the rest of Edinburgh to bounce back. And the thing that helped cinch the deal was you see every so often you get curtains forming. So there was a couple of curtains formed and these are just sort of what look like straight lines coming down through the light that helps convince you that it's the aurora. So I shouted it out to the four people that were in earshot and I had one guy go, "Cheers, pal." So that's my astronomer duty done for the year.
Did Twitter confirm it?
I didn't check actually, but I did go on to
Twitter said it was true.
Well, I went to Aurora Watch and there was an orange spike right across the bells. So about 20 minutes worth of aurora.
There was quite a lot of stuff on social media about it. I did see many posts of people talking about it and saw a bit of prediction, maybe at 11 o'clock. That, obviously, you can tell how exciting my New Year's was. I was on Twitter and Facebook. But there was quite a lot of talk about it. So I kind of believe Ali. We all know he was drunk at the time, but
I was a little bit, yeah. But that doesn't – it makes my eyesight better. It was very cold up there. You have to forgive me that.
So another thing I think in the north at the moment, which you may not have spotted, is there's a comet drifting north. Catalina is up in the north at the moment, but it's
I haven't been chasing that.
I think it's just below sort of naked eye visibility. It hasn't been too impressive. I don't think it didn't flare up as much as some people had dreamt that it would, as is often the case. But it's there if you have a telescope, I think.
It did have a pretty picture. There's always one really uber good amateur astronomer
dedicated person that
just takes an amazing picture of these things. So yeah, I was quite impressed with that actually. But there's no chance of me trying to see
it. But it's there at the moment. So if anyone's keen and got lots of time, possibly a good telescope.
Yeah, and we're finally, this is good news, because we're finally coming round to the right side of the sun to see the rest of the planets. So for ages now, we've been saying there's nothing to see in the evening. So now we're getting to the point where Jupiter's going to be the king of the sky for the next little while. It's at opposition in March, I think, so it's going to look great. And then following hot on its heels, you've got Mars, Saturn and Venus all in the morning sky. So it's only going to get better over the next few months, which is great.
I think Saturn remains one of those objects that if you have a telescope and you've not seen Saturn through a telescope or you have access to somebody with a telescope, you have to see Saturn.
Yeah.
It will just change astronomy for you. It makes it all the more wondrous. It's just one of the best things possible to see Saturn with your own eyes, to see that ring system. Naked eye, it's just awesome.
It's annoyingly low at the moment, so I think you're better off waiting a few months to get it just high enough to stop it wobbling about too much in the eyepiece. But yeah, it's very cool. Who was it that called it a planet with ears? One of the first people to look at it through
I think
telescope?
Galileo did.
Was it Galileo himself?
I think.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, because his telescope was probably too small to resolve the gaps between the planet and the ring system.
And then I think Huygens actually got the ring, got the idea that it was a ring system, I think, a little bit later.
Because you're jumping telescope diameter there, jumping size, jumping optical quality, which means you've got a better chance of seeing things. Small details like that. I say small, obviously they're not small, but on the sky they're quite small.
Can you see Saturn's moons? You can see Titan, can't you?
I think you see Titan, but I don't know if you can see any others.
I don't think.
Well, I thought you could scope, see obviously, two or three, but I could be wrong on that.
Enceladus, just because it's the fun one with the ice geysers.
I think it might depend on the positions and, telescope and how much imagination you've got. As with a lot of these things, you sort of, there's definitely four there. Yeah.
Canals on Mars, easy peasy. I don't think I've ever seen Mars look like more than a dot in my telescope images. So
reddish. See, it's got colour, which is seeing something with colour is pretty good actually. Because most of the things, as you say, most of the things we see is black and white, really. Because our eyes just, our black and white part of our eyes is more sensitive than the colour part, and consequently, pretty much everything you ever look at is going to be black and white, unless the odd planet can just sneak in there at the end of the sensitivity zone of your eyes. So.
I haven't even seen Mercury with my own eyes yet. I'm failing on that front. I told people to go and see it last month and forgot all about it, so I haven't actually seen it this time either. So I'll have to. That's a tough one, though. You've got to get up either really early or time exactly right before sunset. But from Scotland, that is a tough ask because it's very close to the sun. And it's just this tiny, faint dot just before the sun disappears around the corner. So
join us later for more confessions of an astronomer with Ali, expressing all the things he hasn't managed to look at with a telescope.
It's a good job I don't get paid for this.
So I've got a question for the astronomers in the room. So I'm looking at Ali and William for this one. I saw on BBC News the other day, there was a story about the brightest supernova ever captured. You guys want to explain that one to me?
No. I've been reading the paper on this, so I technically should know a lot about it.
When you say reading the paper, you mean the scientific one, not like...
I dived straight in and then realised I know far less about supernovae than I thought I did. So I guess a good place to start would be supernova. What is a supernova? Dr. Taylor, would you care to
elaborate? So, I suppose the basic idea of a supernova is at the end of the life of a massive star. And I'm talking about a star which is tens of times larger than our sun, the star will explode in some fairly violent and quite exciting way. So something like our sun is going to kind of sort of fizzle out a little bit. But if the star's a lot bigger, when it runs out of fuel effectively, so within a star, it's burning away through lots of fuel in its core, at the end of its life, it will you lose fuel and the star starts to almost collapse in on itself and it causes a strange bounce and all the material gets flung out into space. It's a tremendously violent moment. It's a really exciting moment as well.
As an interesting sort of tidbit to go along with that, people say we are made of stardust as a sort of quite a twee and embarrassing quote. Of supernova, any atom, so any material that is heavier, and that's atomically heavier than iron, has to be made in the blast wave of a supernova. So if anybody's wearing any silver or gold jewellery, William's wedding ring, for instance, which I think is...
Palladium.
That was made in the blast wave of a supernova.
Yeah,
and
so not just
the only way it can be made
in a star, but in the last few fractions of a second of a star's life, which is pretty weird and crazy thought. Mm-hmm. And that applies to lots of elements which are in your body. There's small traces of that in your body as we speak. This event which occurs when the star dies, it throws out a lot of material, and of course naturally you get a huge amount of light thrown out. That light will journey its way across space and eventually arrive at the Earth, and we see the star get much, much brighter. There are recorded instances of this happening for nearby stars. In the last few hundred years this has happened, and they're so bright that you can actually see them during the day, which is kind of gives you an idea that these things are crazily bright. But the reason everyone's got very excited about this one is the fact that it's a long way away, but it's still extremely bright. So this is one of the, it's one of the more distant supernovae we've ever seen, but it actually seems to be shining more brightly than any supernova that's ever been recorded.
Well, the numbers from the paper were saying it's about 200 times more luminous than your average supernova.
Yeah.
So it's like the most extreme one that's been seen to date, assuming they've got their numbers right. It's also about 20 times brighter than the entire Milky Way, which is a huge energy budget. I mean, when you think about E equals MC squared and you try and work out if there's enough energy to actually do this, it's very tricky. So it's stretching the limit of what theory allows for these core collapse supernova models. And it gets a bit complicated in the paper, and they are suggesting that maybe there's something called a magnetar on the inside of the supernova. So
isn't this magnetar a transformer?
I kind of wish it was, because I don't hear the term magnetar used very often at all. But what we're more used to is neutron stars. So when a big star goes pop, you can get a stellar remnant. In the case of our sun, you'll end up with a white dwarf. It's very cool. It's like the ember of the star. It's just very dense, massive thing. But it's tiny compared to the original star itself, and it just gets colder over time. Starts off being very hot. If you have a bigger star, you can end up with a neutron star, which is much denser. So you're talking about something the mass of the sun, but compressed into a ball of what is essentially solid neutrons, which wouldn't be much bigger than the city of Edinburgh. So that is, yeah. It's crazy to even think about what a neutron star is like. But a magnetar is just a neutron star with an incredibly strong magnetic field. And when it's first created in this explosion, it's spinning incredibly fast. But because it has a strong magnetic field, you get, through the magic of the physics that is involved with this model that I know nothing about, it's about converting the rotational energy of this massive spinning dense thing using its magnetic field to actually convert that energy into light energy. So you can power up the supernova to make it much brighter than it otherwise would be, because you're getting extra energy for free. Normally the pulsar, the neutron star would just sort of spin down, and you shouldn't see the supernova be affected. So it gets incredibly complicated, and I think the jury's still out on whether or not this is a real, very luminous event, or if there's maybe something else going on.
Yeah, there's
well.
Been some suggestion that maybe it could be a lensing event or something where the light is being magnified in some way, so we're not getting a true signal.
Yeah, they definitely need more follow-up observations. So they took spectra of the supernova, and there aren't very many easily identifiable features in the spectrum. So supernova come in all different flavours, and sometimes you see obvious lines from hydrogen and helium, and they don't see either of those two things in the case of this particular supernova. And the reason that's potentially an issue is not because they're missing, but it's because that helps you pin down the redshift, or the distance to the supernova. So they have lines in the spectrum that tell them there is something at this redshift, but whether or not they're 100% sure the supernova is actually that far away. I mean, we're talking a couple of billion light years away, so it's pretty far away. But in theory, the supernova could have gone off nearer to us. There might just be another smaller galaxy overlapping with this bigger one that you see in the images, and that would remove the energy problems that they see for this object. So I think they're going to get Hubble to go in and take a closer look and see if they can pin down exactly what's going on. But it's very interesting, because anything extreme is interesting.
But personally, I study massive stars, so I find this kind of area really exciting, because these things are pretty rare beasts in comparison to the sort of something like the sun, which is a pretty common, pretty sort of average kind of star. You get very few of these things, and they live really fast lives as well. So our sun's going to sit around doing not much for a few billion years, whereas these stars only live for a million years. So it's sort of a tiny fraction of the lifetime of the sun. And this means that you just don't see many of them. And so because of that, our kind of knowledge of the upper end of sort of the big stars is pretty hazy. I mean, we don't even know how big a star can be. There's plenty of debate about that. There's lots of observations sort of competing, you know, think maybe 200 times the size of our sun. But we're really not sure kind of what happens at that top end. And so often the only thing we get to see about them is when they go boom. Not boom, I should say, because you can't hear them, obviously, the whole sound in space issues. But, I mean, you see these wonderful flashes, but that's seeing the end. That's seeing it after it's happened. And so it's just, yeah, it's a pretty hazy area of physics, this upper end. And you get other flashes. We see gamma ray bursts. You see sort of strange things in the sky which seem to match up with the death rows of big stars. But yeah, it's definitely ongoing research.
I think, if you go online, if you're curious about supernova and how they work, the 1987A supernova, there's now some fantastic time-lapse images of this event. So this is something that went pop in 1987, and they've been in and taking pictures ever since. And I think it's a lot of Hubble images recently, and you can actually see this cloud of stuff that's getting slammed into by the energy from the supernova, and it creates this beautiful sort of, I don't know what you'd call it, a sort of ring of material, and sort of, and it has bright spots in this ring, and you can see this evolving over time. So it's fantastic to watch, and it's very rare that we get a supernova that goes off near enough to us that you see something more than just this point of light in your telescope images.
One final thought on supernova 97A, which was our closest supernova in recent times, the one we could have studied best of all, and when we looked at it, we found out that it was completely the wrong type of star, which we didn't predict would explode. So it was a real bother moment when everyone said, we understand supernova, here's one in our backyard, and it's the wrong type of star.
Yeah, I like astronomy.
Which is
that,
good. It's a challenge.
Yeah.
It's a challenge.
Every time we invent a new instrument or go somewhere we haven't been before, we see something we didn't expect, which keeps things interesting. We'll be out of a job soon if we've
got it keeps us in a job, which is probably the best part of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of people moving jobs and going other places, Tim Peake has been in the news a fair bit. Those of you who don't know...
Sorry, who?
William, you should know better. Tim Peake is the first British-funded astronaut and the first British person to go to the International Space Station. And he left a couple of weeks ago now. So he's been enjoying life on the International Space Station, soaring above our heads now for a couple of weeks. It's worth pointing out that the International Space Station is only about 400 kilometres away. So it's actually not that far away because the orbit's quite low down to the Earth. I did a bit of math on this before coming to record this. That's less than Edinburgh to London.
It's one of the most sophisticated maths, really.
Okay, I pulled up Google Maps and I measured my screen. Yeah. It wasn't maths as such. But it's not actually that far away. I think that still surprises me.
Yeah, we should point this out. That's when it's passing overhead. Yeah. I mean, most of the time it's further away than that. But when you can see it up above your head, which you can sometimes see if you look at the right time of day, there's plenty of websites out there to tell you how to do that. And you can see this little dot shining over. Then it's only 400 kilometres away or so. Yeah. It varies a little bit. It goes up and down a little bit.
But it's also worth pointing out. So Tim Peake this week, did anyone see what he was up to?
I saw a selfie from the spacewalk, which was looking pretty darn good, actually. I don't know how he got the selfie practice in that he needed, and if NASA has actually invented a space selfie stick, which they must have done, but I was quite impressed that he
might have bought it from
everything was in
a
focus.
Passing vendor. He was hawking the things.
He went for a wander outside the space station.
Yes, primarily to do some repairs, I think, rather than take the selfie. I think the selfie was a happy bonus. But I think he was repairing part of the solar panel power relay, I think.
So it was part of the power distribution system from the solar panels. So the solar panels that are on the space station have been there for, I think, 8 years now. The last set were installed about 8 years ago. And solar panels degrade with time. Combination of things like micrometeorite impacts on the space station, just general degrading of the solar cells, has meant that the power has started to drop down. And on top of this, they also had a problem with one of the power distribution modules. My electrical engineering is pretty sketchy, so I'm just going to leave it at power distribution module. But they already had a spare on board the space station, which has been there for 8 years, as it turns out, and has the nickname of Dusty. So last week they got Dusty out of storage and gave it a full test, and it was all working and happy. So this week Tim Peake and his American colleague, whose name I actually can't remember now.
Tim
Copra, was it?
That sounds about
and
right.
They had but to it was use two Tims. The surnames because it was getting confusing.
So the two of them went outside in their spacesuits and put a new power module in. I think they managed to get it fully installed, but they had to cut the spacewalk short because the other Tim, not Tim Peake, the other Tim, he had a leak inside his space station, inside his spacesuit, rather. And when I say a leak, I mean there was some water leaking into his helmet.
Yeah, which you'd point you decide to go in, don't you?
Yeah,
you don't take too many risks when there's a very, very thin layer of material separating you from infinity.
Yeah. Leaks in zero-G are bad. So it happened to another astronaut a few years back. And there was so much water in the helmet, there was a risk of them drowning. And you can't see because of the surface tension of the water, it actually gets into your eyes and you can't do anything. So it becomes a bit risky. So I think that's why NASA were like, a little bit of water, that's enough to pull the plug. And I think they'd already put in absorbent pads or something in the helmets now, so that hopefully would have soaked up some of it before it got too bad.
Well, I think it was. This seemed like quite a small leak, so they weren't too. It wasn't an emergency by any means. It was just, this is not great. We should probably go back inside now.
Yeah. Done 5 hours or something out there, haven't they?
Yeah.
So it takes a reasonable long walk.
Yeah.
It's quite a long shift, to be fair.
And I read that they had to do the bit of the repair in complete darkness, so they needed the space station to be in shadow because there was a risk or a slight risk of an electric shock, because if the solar panels were up and running in full sunlight, then that could create extra hazards. So they had to this 30-minute window to try and get it done. So it sounded a little bit cagey.
So it's definitely a dangerous job, that.
But he still got a great selfie.
He did get a good selfie. Right.
Yeah, he did. Other space-related or space travel-related news? Anyone seen anything interesting?
No, but the two of you have been ranting at me about this wonderful video of a spaceship blowing up or something, but I haven't yet seen it.
Yeah.
So enlighten me.
SpaceX have been so kind in posting high-definition videos of catastrophic failures of their launch vehicles, which is great because they're fun to watch. And they were so close to getting this last one right. You know more about it than I do, though.
I have had a little bit of research, yeah. So this was just yesterday, in fact. SpaceX launched an Earth observation satellite for the Japanese, which they got into space and was all working fine. They got that all up there. And then they brought back down their Falcon 9 rocket. And now the Falcon 9 rocket lands vertically. So a bit like Thunderbird 3 lands vertically on Tracy Island.
That means nothing
to me. What's a Thunderbird?
Yeah. Oh.
No, I'm joking. Thunderbird 3 was a cool rocket one,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, just checking.
So with Thunderbird, so in space, SpaceX
you
and Thunderbird
talking,
3,
I'll hum the
it lands vertically, and this is pretty challenging. It does make a lot of sense to do it this way. They tell me, I'm still not totally convinced on that, but it makes some degree of sense, and it basically makes that lower section completely reusable of the rocket, which saves on launch costs and makes it much more economical, which is SpaceX's overall goal. But they managed to bring this back down onto one of their floating barges to land it on that. And they managed to get it to land and turn the rocket engines off. And then one of the four legs that it rests on when it's on the ground seemed to buckle and fail. And the whole thing just very slowly tips over. And it's just as it touches the barge, the landing pad, blows up spectacularly.
So is that barge gone? Is it reusable?
The barge seemed to do pretty well out of it.
Right, okay.
They seem to be pretty well built. This is like a fully robotic barge that they can just put somewhere and tell it to stay still.
Yeah, so the barge is there so that you can, because you're launching them from coast of Florida, out across the Atlantic, and you put your barge somewhere, presumably
where your rocket's
not just
come
anywhere, in. But somewhere carefully calculated, even more precise at maths than Martin's earlier on, to work out where this thing's going to come down. Okay.
And this is because you want to go. Generally, you want to launch from somewhere on a coast and going in that direction. You want to travel towards the east because that's the direction the Earth is spinning.
So you have a bit of a kick, shall we say the least. Yeah.
You can use a little bit less fuel and get an extra boost going that way. And you want to do it over. You want to come down over water, generally speaking, because there's less chance of hitting things.
Yeah, I suppose historically when they were just dumping stuff into the sea, there really was no control. Mm-hmm. Water was better. Yeah.
But it was just last month, on the 21st of December, that SpaceX actually got a successful landing of the Falcon 3, which was their first successful landing from orbit, which was on ground. So I don't quite sure why they did that one to ground, but that worked absolutely perfectly. So I don't know what the difference is between landing there versus landing on the barge, but I suspect it's some mechanical failure that's done this rocket.
Yeah, 'cause if you can control your landing, why not launch from the west coast of America and bring it down over land? Why keep doing it in Florida?
It's probably another fuel thing. If you wanted to turn the rocket around a little bit or have it go down somewhere sensible, you maybe need to use a little bit extra to point it in the right direction. Whereas, to be most cost effective, maybe you want to use everything for your payload and then rocket comes down where rocket comes down. So you've got to get there.
There's probably a lot of safety concerns as well that, yes, you can controllably land this thing, but if one in every 1,000 times it doesn't land controllably, again, you want to be landing over a barge in the ocean rather than a large city. So I don't know the full logic behind it, but I think that sort of makes sense. And it'll be interesting to see long-term what happens with SpaceX, because they're starting to really control the costs of this stuff I'm still making a loss currently, but they're becoming the main launchers for this.
Yeah, they're close to getting a person on board, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're the closest, I think, of the competing companies working for NASA. I mean, nominally working for NASA. I mean, I think NASA is still ploughing huge amounts of money into this. It's not, we talk about this being a sort of private sector thing now, but it's still a long way from that, isn't it?
Well, I think a lot of the money that NASA's ploughing into that kind of development side of things mostly is going into their longer travel missions.
Yes.
So they're no longer doing orbital flights as such. They're doing, we're going to go to the moon or go to Mars, these kind of long-haul, long-duration space flight, as opposed to the relatively short hop to drop things off in space.
SpaceX are lucky because they overlap with the, we're doing this to get cargo up into space as well, and we can now bolt on humans if we want, whereas Virgin Galactic, it's all about the tourists.
Yeah.
So I don't think things have moved as fast as Virgin Galactic would have liked. They've had setbacks as well, accidents. But it would be nice to see. I'm not going to lie, if I had the money, I would probably be signing up for one of these trips. Might wait until they've finished their full flight certification or whatever it is they have to do. But yeah, it would be worth it.
I think it would. It would be a cool thing to see. You could go and do, to go and pop into space.
In the meantime, there was a story about a theme park, I can't even remember which one now, where apparently they have a ride that simulates going into space. And they combine a VR headset with a roller coaster, and whatever the G-forces are doing to you while the headset is on makes you feel like you're in a rocket launch, which I thought was, you know, that'll be the next best thing that I could maybe afford.
I believe it's Alton Towers.
Was it Alton Towers? So, yeah. Oh, nice, that's close. I was worried I'd have to go to Florida or something. So, okay, that's cool.
You're willing to run the risk, then that's fine.
I'm going to wait to see how many people barf after getting off the ride, and then I'll decide to go on.
Given just wearing a VR headset can make you barf quite badly.
Yeah.
Doing that plus a roller coaster...
that's designed to make you jiggle about, and, you know, I just want to see somebody try and open a can of juice while the rocket's taking off. <That'd be great.
laughs> I'm guessing you can't do that inside the Soyuz. Take a can of Iron Brew to crack open halfway up.
I'm not sure. Is the Soyuz violent? I thought it was quite smooth. I thought the Russians had that way better than the Saturn V. When they were going to the moon, all the astronauts said, I don't know why we bothered training, because it was shaking around so much. If I went to hit a switch, I wouldn't know which one I was actually hitting at the time. So, yeah, it sounds a bit violent.
That doesn't sound very pleasant. Hopefully the ride is slightly less bone-shakingly violent than that one was.
Well, it's tree representative, but yeah.
Well, hopefully maybe next time we're doing a podcast, Ali can come back on and tell us about his adventures in Alton Towers then.
Yeah.
Maybe we get some sponsorship.
As long as you don't ask me questions about Magna Towers, I'll be quite happy, thanks.
Excellent. Well, I think we're going to sign off now. We have to go and write another set of talks because the Royal Observatory of Edinburgh's winter talk season is currently ongoing, and we are giving a talk next week. I think William's going to be away for it, but Ali and I have to go and work out what we're going to say at that to the public that get to come up here and visit. If you want more information on the talks and the events going on at the Royal Observatory, it's worth going on to the website. If you just Google Royal Observatory Edinburgh Visitor Centre, you'll find all the information there. There's the winter talks, there's also public observing sessions and various other activities to get you some more information all about astronomy and the work done here at the observatory. So I think that's enough for today. So thank you very much for listening, and hopefully you'll get to hear from us again fairly soon.
See you later.
Bye-bye.